What really determines whether something's a public record is its content, not the means through which it's transmitted.
The state Supreme Court weighs in on Alaska's public records law. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, October 12th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a reunion of sorts for the survivors and descendants of Attu Island.
They'll gain something by just meeting each other and feeling more connection with each other and with their past.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Alaska Pacific University offers convenient, high-quality, affordable adult undergraduate programs. Applications are due October 19th. Apply at alaskapacific.edu or by calling 564-8248. This message sponsored by APU.
State employees can't use private email accounts to hide their work communication from public record laws. The state Supreme Court issued a decision on the matter today that largely affirms an earlier Superior Court ruling. The case dates back to the Sarah Palin administration and addresses the tricky question of whether the state records law is keeping up with communication technology. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Citizen activist Andre McLeod originally sued the state in 2008 after she discovered Governor Palin was using a Yahoo account to conduct state business. McLeod wanted the court to make it illegal for state employees to use private email accounts for work and said if they did, those emails should be preserved for the public record. The Supreme Court agreed private emails regarding state business should be part of the public record, and McLeod's attorney, Donald Craig Mitchell, calls the decision a victory.
All in all, I think this is an important development for vindicating the public interest in Alaska during the new telecommunications email age.
But the court did not agree with McLeod that state employees should be barred from using private email at all for their work. Mitchell says that's unfortunate, but he says the point may not matter given that Governor Sean Parnell has ordered any state business conducted on private emails to be copied to the state email system so it can be preserved. Dave Jones is an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law. He says the state is pleased with the court's decision, which he says can be boiled down this way.
What really determines whether something's a public record is its content, not the means through which it's transmitted.
Jones says, in principle, the Supreme Court's decision would also apply to text messages. A former state employee has accused the Parnell administration of using text messages to hide state business from public records requests. Jones says he doesn't know whether employees are engaging in that practice, but they shouldn't be.
Most text messages are, by their nature, going to be transitory. That is, not something that is appropriate for preservation. But a state employee could not try to avoid the effects of the Public Records Act by using a text message as a substitute for a public record.
But Andre McLeod's attorney, Donald Craig Mitchell, says even if the intent of the Supreme Court's decision is clear, the public records law needs to be updated. He says state law on the issue hasn't been revisited in more than two decades, and he says that means there's a lot of confusion over how state employees should be using new communications technology.
If anything comes of this, I hope it would be the legislature stepping up to the plate and reviewing this entire area and making some adjustments to the Alaska Public Records Act that would bring that act into the 21st century.
Senator Hollis French, an Anchorage Democrat, agrees the law may need some tweaking.
The question is, are we collecting those private email accounts? Are we collecting those text messages? Are we collecting new modes of communication, a Facebook message, for example? How do we make sure that those get pulled into the permanent public record files that we keep so that the citizens are sure that their business is being done appropriately?
He expects lawmakers to take a look at the public records law during the next legislative session. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
During World War II, the Japanese occupied the Aleutian island of Attu and shipped its residents off to prisoner of war camps. The village was never resettled, and for decades it was all but forgotten. This week, the surviving Attuans and those descended from the village gathered in Anchorage. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce has the story.
70 years ago, Christine Keel's mother was forced out of her Attu home and packed into the cargo hold of a coal freighter bound for Hokkaido. Keel says her mother never talked about the experience, but its shadow clouded her childhood nevertheless.
She was an anorexic because she thought if she gained any weight, she looked Japanese. So she was horribly thin. I remember holding her, and I was only 9 years old at the time of her death. So, I mean, I literally could put my arms completely around her as a 9-year-old. So I knew that something was wrong, even though she didn't verbalize it.
Keel spent this week with 30 survivors and descendants of Attu, learning about the trauma that shaped her mother's life and her own. The event was half reunion and half memorial service.
Blessed memory and blessed falling asleep, do thou grant, O Lord, unto thy servants who perished in Japan during the Second World War as prisoners.
Between speeches and prayer, the group perused historical photographs and elders helped fill in the empty branches on family trees. Of the 42 Attuans who were on the island when the Japanese invaded, only 11 made it back to the Aleutians, and only a handful of those ever set foot on Attu again. The rest died or ended up scattered across the Pacific Northwest.
To be eternal.
Rachel Mason is a cultural anthropologist and the organizer of the Attu reunion, which is part of a larger National Park Service project called Lost Villages.
An obscure corner of U.S. history is what happened to the native residents of the Aleutians during the war. There have been a few videos and books that have come out that have told that story, but what hasn't been known is that they weren't able to resettle in their villages.
Mason is trying to change that. In 2009 and 2010, she arranged for survivors and descendants of the three lost villages on Unalaska Island to visit their former homes. She tried putting together a trip out to Attu as well, but the logistics proved overwhelming. Instead, she settled on the reunion in Anchorage, hoping it would help heal some of the historical trauma. Mason says because the survivors spread out so much after the war, many descendants weren't familiar with their Attuan heritage until recently.
They'll gain something by just meeting each other, being able to share memories of their parents, of finding out that who they're related to, and feeling more connection with each other and with their past.
That's the main reason Christine Keel and her two sisters attended the reunion. They grew up in Washington State and had never visited Alaska before this week. But by the end of the reunion, the sisters had met cousins they never knew they had.
So, strange, saying yeah. Our family.
I know.
We've never had that before. We've only had us.
Yeah. That's what Margaret said. I guess I was like, hey, what's up, cuz? She's like, wow, I'm still in shock. And I said, I know, me too, but I was just trying it on for size. And it felt good. I had a big grin on my face.
The reunion is over, but Christine says for her, this is just the beginning.
My desire for the culture has been set on fire, more so than it was. And I hope that my enthusiasm and desire to be part of my people and a part of the Alaskan culture, it maybe starts a little spark for somebody else that's born and raised here and isn't on fire like I am.
Keel is looking forward to sharing the stories she's learned over the last few days with her daughter back home in Washington. She wants to make sure the next generation understands the complicated family history better than she did. In Anchorage, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, finding a use for one of Alaska's most hated plants.
Out in the woods, deer hunting and such, collecting, harvesting other plants, you always saw that ominous-looking plant and you didn't want to grab onto it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bioneers in Alaska, presenting practical sustainability strategies for Alaskans at its 9th annual conference, October 26th through the 28th at UAA. Bioneersinalaska.org. And by Condor Airlines, with connecting flights from Barrow, Bethel, Juneau, Kodiak, Nome, and Prudhoe Bay to Anchorage on Alaska Airlines, and continuing nonstop service to Frankfurt. Details at condor.com.
A month after opening, Accutan's new $77 million runway still doesn't have scheduled air service. Bids were due Wednesday from airlines wanting to take over the federally subsidized flight route between Unalaska and Accutan, but none were submitted, and the airline that's most likely to take over the route says there are unresolved problems with the mail contract. Grant Aviation's chief operations officer, Austin Engebretson, says the U.S. Postal Service views the village of Accutan and the airport as the same place. The problem is the airport is actually 7 miles away on Accoon Island. He says that means Grant, if awarded the contract, would be responsible for delivering mail to the village.
And that would require us to ship the mail on the hovercraft at our expense to the village of Accutan. The mail rate is roughly 50 cents a pound. That we get paid to haul it, to the airport, and the rough estimates we've gotten from the hovercraft are about $1 a pound to ship it across the bay. So for every pound of mail we would transport, we would take a 50-cent a pound loss. And that's just really no way to do business.
The Postal Service did not respond to requests for more information. Meanwhile, Accutan is facing serious cutbacks in air service. Penn Air is currently serving the community with its World War II-era Grumman Goose seaplane, but Penn Air President Scott Bloomquist says recent modifications to the town's seaplane ramp to accommodate the hovercraft have made it unusable for the Goose. That means the plane has to drive up onto the small strip of rocky beach in front of the village, which could possibly damage it.
We restricted the operation in Accutan to only go in and off that beach on certain tides when we feel the rocks are less exposed.
Bloomquist says the precaution should keep the plane running indefinitely, albeit on a limited and irregular schedule. That means Accutan will continue to have its mail delivered right to the village and the new airport will remain idle. The Fairbanks North Star Borough passed an ordinance Thursday night that creates the Interior Alaska Natural Gas Distribution Utility. Proponents hope it will bring natural gas to Fairbanks in a cheap and expedited manner, but approval didn't come without a last-minute curveball. KUAC's Emily Schwing reports.
The ordinance allows the borough to acquire, own, and operate facilities and pipelines to provide natural gas to residents in what sponsor and assembly member Nadine Winters says is the cheapest and most effective manner.
There's been a general lament both about energy costs and also about the lack of a unified voice in the community about what the solution to our energy costs is. There's some unity among the local government structures in the borough that we have to do something, we have to do something quickly, and we have to acknowledge that this is a hybrid, that the private sector can't take care of this problem on its own. If that was the case, we would have gas and we wouldn't be in this position.
The assembly spent more than an hour picking through the ordinance, questioning everything from the selection process for the utility's 7-member board of directors to administrative fees for grant funding. Conditions put forth by both the Fairbanks and North Pole City Councils when they transferred their utility powers earlier this month have to be included in the legislation. That's part of the reason why Assemblyman Guy Satley offered an amendment.
IANGDU will function first as a facilitator, second as an implementing corporation that contracts, partners, or joint ventures with private companies, and third, as a provider/competitor if services are not currently being provided or if the private entity is unwilling to provide them or will not do so in a timely manner.
The language comes from a section in a City of Fairbanks ordinance. It's not legally binding, but Satley opted to insert it into a section of the borough ordinance that is legally binding. Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins argued that it would create too much confusion moving forward.
Putting it in code takes the intent of what the city had, as it just views the gas utility first as this, second as that, not that it's required to do that.
There is some question about what Satley's amendment means for the creation of the utility. If borough attorney Renee Broker finds that it's problematic, the assembly can introduce an amending ordinance before it goes into effect on November 15th. The Assembly also passed a resolution authorizing startup funding for the new utility. Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins says the funding is essential to get it up and operating.
This utility can't even buy a stapler at this point.
Earlier this year, the state appropriated $3 million for the development of a natural gas distribution system. $350,000 of that will go toward utility startup costs. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
A large contingent of Alaskans is in Wisconsin to attend tomorrow's launch of a new Arctic research vessel that will be homeported in Alaska. The 261-foot ship is called the Sikuliak, the Inupiaq word for young sea ice. It's owned by the National Science Foundation and will be operated by the University of Alaska Fairbanks. KUAC's Dan Bross reports from Marinette, Wisconsin.
Saturday morning's launch of the Sikuliak will see the $123 million vessel slide from dry dock at the Marinette Marine Corporation shipyard and splash into the Menominee River just off Lake Michigan. University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences Director Mike Castellini expects over 3,000 people to attend the big event.
It's a range of all the locals, of course, who want to come in. Politicians to the local school kids to lots and lots of people coming from Fairbanks and Alaska, of course.
Castellini says two UAF marine science faculty instrumental in shepherding the research vessel project are being honored at the launch.
The person who's going to break the champagne bottle over the bow is our very first dean for the school, Vera Alexander. She's been working on this project for about 30 years, and so she's the one who gets to break the bottle. And then, but we have a second sponsor too. His name is Bob Elsner, and he's been working on this project for about 30 years also, and he's also an emeritus. And he gets to be the one that's going to push the button that blows all the explosive bolts that lets it go into the water and everything.
Castellini says Alexander and Elsner's names were welded into the ship's hull during a keel-laying ceremony a year and a half ago. The vessel, paid for with federal economic stimulus dollars, will be unique in the National Science Foundation research fleet for its ability to push through subpolar ice in the Arctic and Antarctic. Tomorrow's launch will be followed by additional outfitting at Marinette, sea trials, and a long journey to Alaska. For KUAC News in Marinette, Wisconsin, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Alaska Pacific University offers convenient, high-quality, affordable adult undergraduate programs. Applications are due October 19th. Apply at alaskapacific.edu or by calling 564-8248. This message sponsored by APU. Breastfeeding leads to healthy babies and healthier mothers. Women who breastfeed are less likely to get breast or ovarian cancer, and babies get fewer ear infections, score higher on IQ tests, and are less likely to be obese as adults. The road to lifelong health begins with breastfeeding. Call 907-465-3100 if you have questions about breastfeeding. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services WIC program, an equal opportunity employer.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Daisha Eaton. This week on AK, plant rehab. Devil's Club is probably best known as a plant to avoid at all costs, but several small Southeast Alaska companies have a different take. They're turning the roots, stems, and bark of the plant into rubs and salves to treat sore muscles and diaper rash. Sitka is the center of a growing industry. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Hello, Winter Song. Great. I'll take your order.
Sitka's Ruth McMaster stands behind the counter at the store she runs with her husband, Gary.
So what kind of salve did you want? One of the Devil's Club and one of the herbal salve? Oh, that's great.
Wintersong makes a variety of products, but its Devil's Club salve and soap are among the most popular.
Gotta get your free sample.
Has the Devil's Club products business expanded?
Oh, yeah. It really has.
And why do you think that is?
Because it works.
Devil's Club is a common shrub in the wet, cold forests of Alaska and the Pacific Northwest. Its bright red berries, tall stalks, and large leaves make it easy to spot. But it's best known for its spiky spines, which cause great pain when they scratch or puncture skin. Jean Longstreth runs Back Bay Botanicals with her husband, Dennis.
Out in the woods, deer hunting and such, collecting, harvesting other plants, you always saw that ominous-looking plant, and you didn't want to grab onto it.
The company, run out of the Longstreths' home, makes Devil's Club salves, balms, and bath oil. Back Bay and Wintersong are among more than a half dozen Alaska businesses making Devil's Club products. Those two and a third make Sitka a center of the industry.
I have the Devil Club oil, the lip balm, the ointment, and the menthol ointment.
Pauline Duncan is a Tlingit author and one of the first Native teachers certified in Alaska. She grew up knowing the roots and bark were a traditional remedy. She followed her interests and built her skills through a class led by a fellow Sitka teacher.
From there, I just started researching and started trying to bring back a lot of the old medicinal plants that were used and mixed that in with the Devil Club.
Duncan and the others collect from their own property or that of family and friends. Wintersong's Gary McMaster says it's careful work.
I usually collect enough that'll, you know, last us for a good while.
The actual harvesting, is that difficult because it's so prickly and stingy?
Well, wear good gloves, you know, wear good gloves.
Then it has to be processed. Back Bay's Longstreth says she uses the same technique for Devil's Club and other medicinal plants.
We use an organic olive oil base, and we simmer the Devil's Club at a certain temperature for a number of days until we get as much of the medicine out of it as we can.
Each follow their own recipe, mixing in spruce pitch, tea tree oil, red clover, beeswax, or other ingredients. The resulting products are used to treat sore joints and muscles and skin irritations such as diaper rash. But none of those remedies have been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration, so Duncan and Sitka's other manufacturers are careful about what they say.
I try to get as many of my buyers to give me a little blurb as to how it has helped them or why they're ordering more. So that's basically how I advertise the product.
Those testimonials are used on company websites or brochures. Back Bay Botanicals' Dennis Longstreth enjoys hearing from the customers.
Every so often, there'll be a little envelope in the mail, and there'll be a little tight little, you know, handwritten address. And inside, we'll open up, and there'll be a letter from a little lady somewhere saying somebody gave her this product, and it did absolute wonders for it.
So why is Sitka a center of Devil's Club products? Wintersong's Ruth McMaster says it's all about attitudes.
There's a lot of independent people here who are seeking out, you know, ways to make money besides working for someone else. There's a lot of entrepreneurs and, you know, crafters and artists, and I think it goes along with the type of people that live here.
A few years ago, some Tlingit leaders were concerned large-scale operations could lead to over-harvesting of the traditional plant. So far, that doesn't appear to have happened. For AK, this is Ed Schoenfeld, reporting from Sitka.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're headed to the small community of Hope, 15 miles off the Seward Highway on Turnagain Arm.
My name is Susan Anderson, and I'm the library director in Hope. I've started this library in 1985. We're small, and we're very close, and everybody works together. I think there's probably a little less than 200 people that live here full-time. We're on Turnagain Arm, so it's just lovely. We have tidal action coming in. We can see whales from here. And seals. Occasionally when we have the fish coming in, we have a salmon stream going, running the length of the valley here in Hope, and we get pinks and silvers and dog salmon, and we get some Dolly Varden trout. So we have wildlife, and it's just gorgeous. Everybody just joins a group and does whatever they like to do. It could be cross-country skiing, or it could be crafting, or it could be church, or it could be just a number of things. But we have quite a few groups in the community that offer a lot of things to do. There is a school. We when I first came here, had, I think it was in the 70s, it had been closed for, gosh, probably about 8 years from lack of students. It was probably less than 8 at that time. And so I believe, well, they had to borrow a child from Anchorage for a year to reopen the school. We have a store, and we have a gas station. We have a church, and we have a retreat center, a Methodist retreat center that can be rented for people to come stay. We do have one dinner house by reservation only that stays open through the winter. I know there's a lot of people that go through, and they say to me, I've lived in Alaska 30 or 40 years, and I've never been down this road. And but once they do, they come back again and again, and it's very telling that so many people do that.
That was Susan Anderson, who started the Library in Hope. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ed Schoenfeld, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Stephanie Joyce in Anchorage, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, and Dan Bross in Wisconsin. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Bioneers in Alaska presents the latest local, national, and international sustainability developments at its 9th annual conference, October 26th through the 28th at UAA. Our own backyard offers inspiration as well as practical strategies for Alaskans with presentations on energy, eating local, green building, and keynote speaker Apila Colorado. Connect with Alaskans and communities across the U.S. Learn more at bioneersinalaska.org. This message sponsored by Green Star. Winter in Alaska can be tough on children and adults with asthma. Cold air and smoke from wood stoves is hard on the lungs. More time is spent indoors with dust, and colds and flus are common. Take care of yourself and loved ones with asthma during these colder months. Get a flu shot. Talk to your health care provider about asthma management. Take daily medication and know what can make asthma worse. For more information, visit asthmainalaska.org or call 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers loans tailored for first-time homebuyers, plus home choice education seminars that can help determine if a mortgage would be less than rent. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.